How are you?
Morning. Chair notes presence of quorum. Get rolling. Patricia, are you ready with our safety briefing for the morning?
Yes. Good morning, and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. At this time, if you could silence any of your noise-making devices, that would be appreciated. In the event of a fire, the alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors in the front of the room, then the first door on your left, moving west towards a parking lot along parking area along Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to any emergencies. Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. We have approval of the minutes as the next action item on the agenda. Any edits to the minutes from last meeting? Hearing none.
Just noting that Dave Whipple was not here at the last meeting. It was Joe Storff. I'll make that correction.
Any misattributions? Is that page one?
Yeah.
Page one, David Whipple explained.
Line 14.
Yes. We're easily confused. Okay, so I'd sort of consider that to be a technical correction.
Yeah.
We need a motion for that, but would like a motion on approval of the minutes.
I'll make the motion.
Motion's made by
Second.
Bill, second by Heather. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Say no. Thank you. I'd note, because that provided me a good reminder, that Phil Davis, Board Member Davis, is with us on the phone today. Phil, how's the audio working for you?
Sounds great. I hope you can hear me. Not that I'm going to say anything.
Well, we might have to call on you just to make sure you're awake.
Absolutely.
And noting, Phil, that this probably serves as your last Board Practices Board meeting, I wanted to express my appreciation for your service to the people of Washington as a member of the Forest Practices Board beginning in February of 2012. And it sounds like the plan is that that this is the last meeting for you. Is that true?
Yeah, that is the plan. And if I could just have the floor for 2 seconds.
You bet.
I personally wanted to thank you all for the opportunity to serve our state in this important area of managing our timber resources, and I'm sorry that my other life commitments don't allow me to continue. Ultimately, my wish is that the future debate, and it certainly seems like the agenda over the coming months will involve future debate about how this resource is managed, remains grounded in objective science and never gets hijacked by ideology, which obviously seems to be a growing trend in solving our common challenges. Let's hope that that's avoided in this process. And I just wish you all the best in the future endeavor, because it's important work. So, again, thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. Thank you very much, Phil. And I think we'll all agree to hold ourselves to that standard. So, that constitutes most of my report from the chair as far as that agenda item is concerned. We have a couple of consequential and important topics to work on today. I'm grateful for your attention, as always, and for your participation with it. With that, I think what we'll do is just move into the general public comment period. Okay, we have 7 folks signed up for general public comment, beginning with Vic Musselman. Let's go with 3 minutes apiece.
I'll do less than 3 minutes so we can let people go without more.
Subject to the discretion of the chair.
And the speaker.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Victor Musselman. I'm the chair of the Washington Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. And I wanted to come before you to say that at our October 31st, 2013 meeting, two members of the compliance monitoring team, Mr. John Heimberg and Mr. Matt Clevenger, who presented us with all the details surrounding the 12 20-acre exempt FPAs that were sampled during 2012 and found to be non-compliant. The information presented was very revealing, and the WFFA caucus of the committee wishes to thank the two gentlemen for their time and insights and for the DNR to allow them to come and talk to us. Through the advisory committee, the WFFA is willing to help the Forest Practices Board and the DNR work on reducing the high noncompliance rate by first identifying ways to solve the common problems that we found on the 31st. Secondly, we believe that at least in some instances, these problems are driven by underlying issues associated with ambiguity in both the 20-acre exempt rule and the instructions leading up to its implementation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vic. Questions?
Did they think that would be it?
Second sign up for public comment is Rob Kavanaugh.
Good morning, board members. My name is Rob Kavanaugh, and I'm here to talk about the future of the Western Gray Squirrel and the future of Title 222 and Title 77. Correspondence with Governor Inslee indicates that the governor and his staff feel that the primary responsibility for the long-term viability of the Western Gray Squirrel does not rest with you. I disagree strongly with that. You're the only ones who have authority to write forest practices permits. But the governor feels that it is on the shoulders of the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to protect the long-term viability of the Western Gray Squirrel. And he anticipates that as a result of the work that they have been doing and coordination with you, they will come up with a Western Gray Squirrel management concept that will protect the Western Gray Squirrel. That remains to be seen. It's a very complex issue, and it involves more than just a Western Gray Squirrel nest tree. It's the whole forest ecosystem that is involved in this issue. And many of you have technical backgrounds, and you understand that a forest is more than just a tree. A forest is everything that's made up of the forest. And the approach that we're using right now to defer the issue over to the Department of Fish and Wildlife if there is a suspected Western Gray Squirrel nest tree hasn't worked. That's why we are where we are today. That's why we're down between 500 and 700 Western Gray Squirrels estimated in Klickitat County. So the system that we devised failed. It worked for a while. The voluntary system did work for a while. And during that time, there was, at the lower staff levels, a lot of close cooperation and coordination. But that has ceased. Now it is devolved into a system of notifying the permittee, well, you may have Western Gray Squirrels out there. You better check with somebody in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And that isn't going to make it. That isn't going to have the Western Gray Squirrels survive. So we've got to do better. And the better is already provided to you in Title 222. The policy is right there. You can do it. You've been doing it with the spotted owl. And you can do it with Western Gray Squirrel. It's just a matter of will and knowledge and your intent to do what you're supposed to do, to follow the provisions of Title 222 as the legislature set forth. So I hope you'll do that. I hope you'll take that under consideration and your decisions of what it is you're going to do. Irregardless of what Fish and Wildlife does, you have a primary responsibility. And so far, you've ignored it. I do not think the voluntary approach will ever work. And I think we've got to do better if we're going to have viable Western gray squirrels. So that's my suggestion. Thank you.
Ken Miller.
Good morning, Chairman Everett and members of the board. Excuse me. I'm Ken Miller, a small family forest owner and volunteer who's been supporting forests and fish in a variety of ways and venues for more than 10 years now. You have in your packets a condensed forest and fish regulatory history from a small forest landowner perspective. This historical summary was prepared for our new WFFA leadership strategic planning, but may also be helpful to you, particularly those of you relatively new on the board. Very briefly, it quotes some forest and fish regulatory commitments to smalls for alternate prescriptions for smaller harvests and summarizes three significant and unsuccessful regulatory efforts: a new rule, a new template, and legislative definition change. There's no need to go through the history today other than to say that small forest landowners are still hopeful for full implementation of the package we call forest and fish. It is noteworthy to say that we have had help, or at least empathy, from all of the other stakeholders, many of whom have made significant efforts to meet their interpretation of the SFLO intent embodied in forest and fish. When preparing this historical regulatory look back, it occurred to me that perhaps the main reason we failed to get smaller buffers for smaller, lower impact harvests is that the stakeholders didn't really share a common agreement and understanding of the RCWs and WACs commitments, and still likely don't. We've had many tactical and or other micro discussions and negotiations and even some regulatory successes around the edges, but we've never had a high-level discussion about the key regulatory commitments to smalls in forest and fish. How can we expect implementation of the forest and fish intent with respect to small forest landowners if there's no real agreement on the commitments to begin with? I think it's time for a higher level clarity to help us all avoid mistakes of the past. I think there's a role for the Forest Practice Board, or perhaps a subcommittee of you. I know there's a role for each of the forest and fish stakeholders. I hope all of you and the key stakeholders in the audience will reach out to our new WFFA leadership with an eye towards clarity of the core issue first, and then perhaps a more viable regulatory pathway that honors forest and fish we all supported. Thank you for listening. I'd be happy to take any questions if there's time.
Questions for Ken?
Ken. Thank you.
Chris Mendoza.
Good morning, Board. Chair Everett, thank you for the opportunity to come before you and speak this morning. First and foremost, I wanted to make it clear to Sam, representing myself as a member of the public, and no one in this particular room or this capacity. And I'd like to start by saying that as prior SEMER co-chair for 5 years, I'm finally stepping down, and I wanted to thank the tribes for fulfilling that position. I think initially folks wanted 2 years, look at those terms, but as some of us know, and I think people can attest to, particularly Mr. Bernath back there, that it's hard to get someone else to do your job when no one wants to do it. Anyway, I wanted to thank the tribes for stepping up on that one. And then lastly, I'd like to take just a couple minutes and share some of my experience and hopes for the program based on that experience I had there. First of all, I wanted to acknowledge the board and their role in the Adaptive Management Program and how your job is pretty much to take information that's generated by SEMER and other best available science and use it in your decision-making process. There can be obstacles to that, of course, when you have a policy body that tries to solve your problems before they get here. Having been part of that process from the science end, I think that that body can be successful at times and then not at others. Of note would be the type F and N issues that we first grappled with 6 years ago, and that is now being dealt with again. And what I'm hopeful for is that this time around that they will get resolved, and that we won't end up doing a replay, in other words, because I think that in itself probably creates the most inefficiencies in the program. When something gets close to being resolved, and then it's dropped at the last second, and then you have to pull all your resources and time and energy together again later to do it all over again. So that I'm hoping for. Also, I would like to state that the new processes that have been adopted by the board under the settlement agreement hopefully will solve some of these problems, and as the settlement partners have agreed to abide by them. And having been part of the dispute resolution process in CMER, which only has occurred twice in the, I think, 8 years I've been there, of which I've been a part of, they were resolved. And I'm hopeful that this body will be able to resolve their issues as well. Thank you for your time.
Peter Golden.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Board. Peter Goldman, Washington Forest Law Center, representing the Conservation Caucus. And I'd like to thank Vic for allowing me to speak on behalf of the small forest landowners today. I appreciate that very much. I was wondering if my friends at WFPA would like to, as long as I'm up here, I can represent them as well, in court.
Thanks for that.
Watch that cup of coffee in front of him, please. So what I'd like to briefly comment today is on policy and the development of the Type F process. This is an extremely important process, as you know. Not only are we testing all the limits of dispute resolution, but we're actually laying out something that's extremely important for many of the caucuses, which is getting to a permanent water typing rule and realizing complete protection for fish and aquatic species throughout the forested land. Because this is in dispute resolution, we're in mediation right now, the actual details are confidential. I don't mean to insult the board, but they're confidential. We're not allowed to certainly to share what who's saying what and what's going on. We are in the second phase of dispute resolution. The first phase was just facilitated. The second phase is actually with an attorney mediator. And it's quite amazing to see the amount of time that all of us have put into it, days and days and days of mediated sessions, compromise, very civil discussions. It's actually working quite well from a civility standpoint, and I think the process is working. DNR is investing a lot of money in our mediator and this process, so we have a lot invested in it. But at the same time, I would like to make this simple point. And that's that the board, this board today, as it's hearing the presentations, should encourage policy to come to the board with a consensus or non-consensus recommendation. We can only do the board's work, part of the work for the board, but at the end of the day, this board needs to get involved and provide us at our level guidance with that which we cannot agree with. Policy is a committee of this board. And at the February meeting, you will likely be either hearing from us in a consensus report on how the permanent water typing rule should be implemented, or the areas of agreement, which caucuses are taking which, have agreed to which, and then this board will have to kind of take it from there. So I think that's a healthy process. We might be able to give you everything, we might not, but it is a healthy process. That's the way it should work, and encourage the board to ask a lot of questions of the presenters on where it's going. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Karen Terwilliger.
Good morning, Chair Everett and members of the board. My name is Karen Terwilliger with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and golly, if I would have known Peter was going to talk about TypeF, I would have come up here with him. Peter's right. We have been engaged in discussions about water typing on non-fish-bearing and fish-bearing waters for some time now. The last time that it was before the board was, I believe, in 2005. This is an extremely important process going forward. We are in mediation, and we are working very hard to bring a consensus recommendation to you. This is critically important for the protection of public resources, as well as dealing with the viability of the forest products industry. And so we're dedicated to this process. Forestry, as you know, has a pretty good track record in terms of dealing with these kinds of issues. And some of the good news you may hear today or maybe in February is discussion about how the RMAP process is working. We've spent, industrial forest landowners and small forest landowners have spent about $170 million up in the watersheds to open up fish culverts and to create opportunities for road abandonment and making sure that our roads actually meet some really strict standards. Our adaptive management process has been working really well in terms of moving forward and trying to identify science-based issues to solve throughout the process. We have a pretty unique system here in the country. An HCP on a programmatic forest practices act that tries to balance four very important goals: harvestable fish, clean water, protection of aquatic life, and forest industry viability. This is all important in terms of the process moving forward. So I just wanted to say in the end, we're definitely committed to the mediation process, the forest and fish PFW process. We need to make sure that we celebrate some of these successes like RMAP and continue the progress on tough issues. I think Chris Mendoza's statements were really appropriate in terms of the discussion of the way CEMER and policy works. And over time, this is a very complex management system. And we need to continue to make sure that that system works and work towards improving it in the future. So thank you.
Thanks, Karen. So we have kind of an extended staff report section of the agenda, and that's because there's a couple of things that I want to draw out and make sure we spend some time on. The first of those is asking Stephen Bernath and Adrian Miller, our policy co-chairs, to come up and join us. So while they're gathering their thoughts, board members will notice that in the memo we received from policy co-chairs, a couple of the board's requests have been or are reflected, particularly in this last table with the policy workload items, the origin of the issues that we're working on, the major milestones and due dates, and I think that's a positive development for planning and moving through policies working in an orderly way. A couple of issues were outstanding at the time of the memo. The first of them is the status of mass wasting discussions. The second is hydraulic code revisions and adaptive management, appendix M review of hydraulic code revisions. And so I was looking for an update on those two items in particular and such other thoughts as you may choose to share.
So I'll address mass wasting pretty quick. As the board is aware, the policy has received the final package for the post-mortem study and are in the process of making some recommendations. We are, in my mind, extremely close to coming to a set of consensus recommendations, but since they're not fully cooked, I don't want to go into too much of the details, but what I can do is characterize sort of the general areas that policy is focusing on. And I look at that in sort of four kind of buckets. I think there's going to be a section of, I hesitate to call them recommendations, but sort of affirmations of actions that have been taken by the department, by the board, by other stakeholders in terms of addressing risks from mass wasting that have happened since the 2007 storm. The point being, we didn't wait several years to do anything. The second piece is, I would say, sort of a set of recommendations around compliance monitoring and looking at whether or not it makes sense to sort of raise the review of mass wasting prescriptions within the queue of compliance monitoring. The two more substantive buckets have to do primarily with the Department of Natural Resources review process and really getting a much better understanding of what that entails. So when an application comes in, how is it screened for risk? What is the process? What is the documentation? And that's right where we're at is really getting, you know, to be frank, getting that sort of in writing so people can see it. People have heard it, it's been presented, and stakeholders like what they hear, but figuring out a way to sort of put that into some sort of substantive form for people to say, yes, that's what we think makes sense, and we're glad you're doing it. And the final piece is you'll be likely aware that the postmortem report, as well as a lot of other geologic research, has indicated, you know, often in science it creates as many questions as it answers. And one of the things that we're going to be working on, I believe that policy will make a recommendation around, is to take a strong look at the research strategy about mass wasting. With new technologies being more heavily utilized, broader sets of screening tools available, you know, there's some, it's worth another look at. And there's some very specific targeted research recommendations coming out of that pertain more directly. So bottom line is we're making very good progress. I would anticipate that certainly by the February board meeting, we'll have the Adaptive Management Administrator actually will have a formal set of recommendations from policy. Is there anything else, Aaron, you want to add?
Well, I just appreciate your work and the Policy Caucus's work on that set of issues. The depth of examination of the issues is a little hard to encapsulate in a 30-second update, and so I think we'll spend a considerable amount of time helping board members come to a more complete understanding of that at some point in the future. But those of you who were here will recall that this is a pretty meaty and weighty and essential issue for us to get our arms around and be sure that we're handling it in a way that's appropriate to protect public resources. So I just wanted for everyone to get a contemporary update on where things stood. I'm pleased that things are progressing. And thanks for your work on it. Hydraulic code.
Good morning, members of the board, staff, and publics. I'm Stephen Burdap with the Department of Ecology and co-chair of the Policy Committee. We had a lengthy discussion last Thursday on whether to accept review of appendix per appendix M of the proposed hydraulic update, rule update. And basically we did not have consensus to move on that. It was a good discussion about what would be value added around that discussion. And basically everybody is encouraged to independently, because many of us were gonna do that anyway, to submit comments to the Department of Fish and Wildlife during their regular rulemaking process. And there was also some conversation about the fact that any changed forest practice rules under the adaptive management process requires either something to go through adaptive management to be directed by a legislature or by a court order. So the potential of this coming back to you as part of a process is high, assuming that the Fish and Wildlife Commission passes a new rule sometime in the future. So that's a summary of the conversation.
And the reason I raised this, and we've got a board work plan item as the last item on today's agenda, so you've got some time to sort of think about this and chew on it a little bit. is that, you know, in passing, the legislature's passing of Second Girl Senate Bill 6406, the hydraulic code immigration bill, this issue of an adaptive management check-in on any hydraulic code revisions that WDFW might propose got a lot more formal for this board, and so I think policy's choice that consensus was not likely to be reached on some of the issues that are still outstanding was a correct choice. I think we could see policy spend an awful lot of time and energy on this issue without any kind of consensus resolution to it. I'm a little uncomfortable though with just kind of taking a pass. And even if we create for policy a collection of those independent comment letters through the Adaptive Management Program Administrator to be forwarded to WDFW, and that's a sort of a procedural thing and not really an added substance type of an issue, I think that better covers the board's obligation and Adaptive Management's obligation under this set of circumstances around potential hydraulic code revisions. And so I'm thinking about that. I think that has, I think it's unwise to just take a pass completely. And this isn't much more than a pass. What I've just outlined is not much more than a pass. But it's something that I want board members to consider when we call up the 2014 work plan issue on the action agenda item for later in the day. And if you need to shop that issue around and talk about it with folks in the intervening time, why go ahead and do that. I think it'd be beneficial for the individual caucuses who so choose to submit their input to Jim, to the Adaptive Management Program Administrator, and have that forwarded to WDFW so that there is an official sort of adaptive management conduit for those items. I know that wasn't discussed in policy the other day, but...
which is why we're remaining very tight-lipped.
Happy day for you. Are there other issues that
yes,
you all wanted to share with us?
A couple of other things. What the memo doesn't talk about is some of the regular CEMER activities that will be going on. We anticipate two or three studies coming to our plate this next year, so those will, of course, will take priority because we want to pay attention to the science and whether it has any influence on it or whether we end up bringing some recommendations to you for change or not as a result of that science. Second, I wanted to put on the record that we restarted some of our accountability items in the policy and CEMER process. I've asked the Adaptive Management Administrator to give us a briefing every 6 months on budget and show us the difference between what we've allotted through the board's approval every time we approve the CEMER work plan and budget versus what is actually expended. And I've also asked for a quarterly report from the Adaptive Management Administrator for all the projects so that we can understand when a project is stuck and work to unstick it. So, those are the other two things I wanted to mention. Did you have
just a couple things? And you know, under the sort of broad umbrella of policies workload, you know, as several people testifying earlier talked about the amount of time we're spending working through the Type F issue, time well spent, but certainly a significant expenditure of human resources, frankly, more than the dollar amount. As Stephen indicated, you know, there are other CEMER projects that come to us, and we have no way of predicting whether or not those will actually require some sort of action. Oftentimes, these studies come to us, and we say, great, thank you very much for your work. You know, it essentially validates an uncertainty or a specific rule or some part of that. But once in a while, one actually does warrant some debate and action. And so we have pretty tight timelines to manage those. So we need to make sure we retain some capacity in that program to deal with what I would consider sort of the normal business of adaptive management. Additionally, we've got things that are driven by, I'll say, external processes, and many of these that we've talked about, with the exception perhaps of the mass wasting. Those, you know, the board can't control in terms of workload. And, you know, just lastly, I know we're going to have a few, what I would characterize as, I hope, relatively minor sort of rule changes that I'm guessing you'll discuss later in more detail. Sort of three new areas actually initiating from the Department of Natural Resources in terms of rule clarification, things that on their face make sense. But again, that will have to probably come through this process. And so as you're thinking about the board's work plan, you know, I'm going to be a broken record, be thinking about this group's work plan.
I want to come back to, Stephen, your accountability discussion and again, express, you know, my appreciation for that. What I'd like to see, but without objection from the board members, is that particularly those quarterly reports on the CEMER project status get attached to your regular memo to the board, so that we are either policy, they come from policy or come from the adaptive management program administrator in his monthly or quarterly report to the board.
No problem. In fact, we could probably submit to the board the information that he supplied last week to us.
That would be beneficial for us all, I think. Okay, any questions for Stephen or Adrian? Paul?
I wanted to go back to the dispute resolution process on the Type F for a second, and both in the public comment, and I think you guys have referenced how much time it's taken, and I'm wondering if you can elucidate a little bit the point in time at which the discussion stops and something is brought to the board, whether it's consensus or non-consensus. And I'm thinking just in terms of the amount of time envisioned to be spent in the future. And is there is that hard and fast, or is there any choice? Is there a way to, you know, kind of get that wrapped up as quickly as possible?
Yes, if I got your question right. The current process we're in is stage two of dispute resolution. It's supposed to end on December 5th, or the next policy meeting, and we'll have to make a decision at that time as to, is this the end? Does that mean that we have sort of three choices? We're done. We don't see a way to get to consensus, and therefore we're going to wrap this up with a bow and bring it to you. Or three, we have made enough progress, we feel confident, we've made substantive progress, and we want to move the deadline forward by consensus. And so those are our three choices coming in early December as to stage two of the dispute resolution.
Is the bow in rule? Okay. Other questions for Stephen Rader? I think if we're going to put it in rule, it'd be wrapped up in barbed wire in that case. Any other questions for the policy co-chairs? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mark, would you come join us on the rulemaking activity in 2013 work plan accomplishments? I want to just spend a couple of seconds on this. So this for board members is the Mark's staff report on rulemaking activity in 2013 work plan, and you flip over to the back page of it, back two pages of it with the table, and task by task, item by item, and with one notable exception anyway, I know an awful lot of completeds on an awful long list, and I don't want that to pass without noting for you all, for the work that we've done together on this 2013 roster of pretty considerable stuff, and for our staff and for policy and the folks who support the work of this body, this was a pretty big year. You want to have anything to add, Mark?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. It was a very good year.
Often we hear about all of the issues and the extra time and things that we're always seem to be wrestling through, but it is rather satisfying to look at the 2013 work plan and see so many completed items on this plan. There are a few things that have been rolled over, and the policy co-chairs basically shared them with you, so that's all I have.
I thank you for pointing that out. It is pretty great to see, Mark. And you mentioned, with one exception, I just want to say that program funding is a big deal for us. I mean, we've got a lot of good work going on, but there's just an uncertainty ahead of us in terms of funding. So I'm just talking to the board here. This is something that we all need to pay attention to. Look for some solutions to get on a firm footing so we aren't every biennium having to scramble to know what kind of program we're going to be able to carry forward and how we're going to be able to carry forward these long-term projects under CMER, which are so necessary.
That was it. Just a recognition item. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. You caught it by surprise.
Just like the surprise ones. I guess I wanted to note that we have a piece of the next item under staff reports is review of the need for Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group. I didn't put this on the agenda as an action item because I think there's a continuing need for the Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group. There's a different opinion on the board. I'd be happy to listen to that. But the board doesn't need any particular action other than to receive a recommendation from staff on that issue. I don't think we actually need a vote on continuing the conservation advisory group. It's just a review. Is that correct? Did you have something else on the agenda, Patricia?
No, I just thought you might have skipped something. But
haven't done that yet.
No.
I want to talk to Tammy next.
Yeah,
Chair. For the record, my name is Tammy Makita. I manage the small forest landowner office, and today I'm excited to give you an update on the status of the Forestry Yard Bare Easement Program. So what I would like to show you some of the accomplishments that we've achieved in the 2011 and 2013 biennium, and talk about the goals that we have set for the 2013 and 2015 biennium within our funding allotment. So for the 2011 and 2013 biennium, we were allotted $1 million from the state capital budget. And with this money, we purchased 13 easements for a total value of $722,573. We also were able to cruise a number of easements for a total of $72,584. As you know, the FREP reform legislation now allows the program to start valuing the easements as soon as the applications come in versus the old method was we weren't able to value the easements and cruise them until the funding was available. So now we are able to, this biennium, we are able to go in and start cruising and valuing the easements as soon as possible. This allows us to get to capture the value of that easement as soon as possible. There's a long list on the applications, and if we can't cruise them until funding comes available, sometimes that's 5 years later, which there could be catastrophic events that happen in that easement, blowdown, that sort of thing, that we may not be able to capture that value. So the remaining $200,000 or so dollars was for our staffing, which was 1.5 full-time equivalents. Of the 13 easements that we purchased, they ranged from $2,832 up to $268,000. These easements incorporated compensating for timber and unstable slopes, as well as for riparian management zones. However, for this biennium, I looked back and we didn't have any unstable slopes in these 13 easements. The acreage that acreage per easement ranged from 1.8 to 32.5 acres. And for protection purposes, we protected between 820 and 6,882 feet of type F waters per easement. And so I want to give you an idea, just give you a little sense of some of the easements that we purchased. This is the second largest easement that was granted. It was for 27 acres along the Ho River. It contains some very nice features that were inside the riparian areas. As you can see that we have a type A wetland, which is right here, a number of type B wetlands that were incorporated into the easement. We also have a forested wetland that's along here. And we were able to protect about 1,800 feet of the CMZ along the Ho River. So this was a very unique easement. It contained mainly deciduous trees, red alder, black cottonwood, but there were also some very large Sitka spruce and western hemlock, about 70 inches diameter along the Ho River. The next easement contained some other unique features as well. This is a 6.7 acre easement for $30,823. It's located north of Tenino, and this easement, this water flows right into Offutt Lake. It contains two type A wetlands. These are type A wetlands in here, as well as a type B wetland that was protected. Timber in this easement contained mostly deciduous trees, with red alder being the major species. So one other, we had two easements that I wanted to bring up that we acquired during the 2011 and 2013 biennium, which raised a few questions as to whether or not they would be eligible as small forest landowners. Both of them were limited liability corporations. One applicant appeared to be a realtor who, based on a staff knowledge of this person's business, was had been buying and selling land, so we weren't sure that person would be eligible under the small forest landowner eligibility requirement. It just so happened that this easement was the largest easement that we acquired for $268,492. The other easement acquired was for a for-profit land trust. This land trust had a parent company, which leaves one to question as to whether this parent company owned multiple land holdings or not. We couldn't get that information. And this easement was purchased for $55,900. So those were some of the questions that were raised during this biennium of the easements. So the status of the current applications, we've got 115 applications on file. We receive, on average, about one application per month, and I think with the timber market increasing and improving, we will be receiving a lot more than one per month. We have calculated that if we wanted to buy all of the easements that are on the list, it would take $10.4 million to purchase all of them. And as you know, the compensation is on a first-come, first-served basis. So, as I just told you, it's a 5 to 6 year wait for compensation. Actually, the landowners that were compensated in this last 11-13 biennium had applied for the program in 2007 and in 2008. So they've been on the list for quite a long time. Okay, so what are we doing for our 13-15 biennium? We received $2 million, so we doubled our money for this biennium. We are looking at purchasing 15 easements. The easements are valued a lot larger this year, or this biennium, than last biennium. The $1 million estimated total value is what we're going to be spending. We have a goal to, the estimated compensation is between $7,690 and upwards of $280,000 again. So it's a broad range of compensation. Acreage is from 1.6 acres for an easement upwards of 60 acres, which is the $280,000 compensation. We haven't actually been able to value all of them, so these are estimates at this time for most of them. It's our goal to identify and cruise the qualifying timber for all of the applications on the list. That's the, all of the 115 plus the one per month that we're going to be acquiring. That's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort. We also want to acquire additional easements, of course, as the budget allows. And in order for us to be able to get in and value these easements that are on the application list, we are hoping to hire an additional natural resource specialist. So that's what we're planning for the 2013-2015 biennium. Does anyone have any questions?
I asked for Tammy to come talk to us for two main reasons. One is that it's the first time in a while we've gotten substantial funding in FREP, and I wanted for board members to have experience with what those projects were, and also, the second reason is those last two easements that were kind of, I took a long look at them and had a hard time, you know, recommending them to the commissioner to sign as good and right projects that meet with the statutory intent of the program. I recall the work that was done to try and reform the program only a couple of years ago. And though we have in this case, you know, a full third of the program appropriation going to two easements that I don't know if they're really meeting the intent of the program. I think we probably have more discussions to undertake around prep reform.
So I'll be interested to see after you cruise the 113, is it, next year, whether the 10 million stays.
It'll be higher than that. I would bet.
I guess, Nick, just a question in doing simple math. If you can do planning on 15 for this biennium, and you're getting one in a month that will probably increase because of markets, it looks like we're losing.
So we're behind the eight ball.
And, you know, with the promise, as Ken's testimony, promise and forest and fish, I am concerned that we're not fulfilling a promise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With the increase in applications and only doing 15, we're going to have more. The list will be larger by the end of next biennium. That's correct.
I'll share with the board from, you know, the agency standpoint in requesting funding for the full backlog of FREP at the onset of last regular legislative session, and then in the numerous subsequent discussions that were had with legislators who have the purse strings, that the program continues to be tough to get funded at the full level. And some of it is, there are examples like the couple of projects that we had a little trouble feeling like met with the program intent. Some of it is, I think, philosophical disagreements that persist around forest and fish in general. I think it would help the viability of the program to go back and look at reform again. And I understand it's not the purview of the board. But it is the purview of the board, in as much as, you know, we can request that conversation take place, for example, in the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. Because it really stuck in my craw, I have to say. It really stuck in my craw to have a third of the program appropriation go to a couple of projects that just didn't seem to me to be compensating for what the legislature has identified as disproportionate regulatory impacts on small forest land. So, anybody else have any thoughts about that? Heather?
Actually, I just have a question, being very familiar with the program. What restrictions does the conservation easement put on the property?
It's a 50-year easement, and they have to maintain. We acquire the timber, we don't acquire the land. So they're required to leave the timber standing. They can't, any trees that come down, they're required to leave them for 50 years, and they have to maintain it and maintain the riparian function of the easement.
So you're saying that, back to your comment, you approve those because the way the rules are written, they qualify. So now you're thinking that maybe the rules need to be changed because it wasn't meant for the original intent.
Yeah, I guess I qualify by saying I didn't disapprove them because the statute doesn't allow us to. And there's a reason the statute doesn't allow us to, because people didn't want DNR to be jiggering around with who got,
right,
who was a priority and who wasn't and all that sort of thing. I understand. But in the case of those two easements, if I had the opportunity to say no, I would have said no.
I have two quick questions. One is, do you guys have a per acre average value of the cost of the easements in the program?
I'm sure we do. I know Dan manages that, and is that something that you would be interested in seeing? I could get that for you.
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting to know.
These are riparian forests, and so they vary from almost pure hardwood stands to stands that are predominantly conifers. So an average would really be kind of a pretty swag between both bookends.
Right. And the valuation of these easements is mostly on timber value. Is that true? There tends to be not very much development value.
Development value at all. It's we go out and cruise the timber. We calculate the value of the timber based on the value at the time that they harvested, and the easement purchase is based on that value.
Okay. My second question is just a curiosity about one of these cases that you said stuck in your craw. For-profit land trust, that's not a construct that's very common. I mean, most land trusts are 501c3s. And so I don't know if there's more details about this case that you can talk about, or this particular situation, but I would just be...
I don't think we're breaking any confidentiality rules, mm-hmm, simply because there's nothing as confidential. EcoTrust, who had...
It was their LLC.
Yes.
Yes, but that's they're not a land trust. They're a timber purchasing...
But they have two sides.
Right.
Right.
But the LLC is not a land trust.
Right.
It's a private business.
And the issue being, is the land trust business side a small forest landowner? Mm-hmm. Do we think in terms of what the purpose of the program was, that the land trust LLC is in fact what was intended by a small forest landowner? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, wanted to daylight this and have some discussion around it. I think it's important. I think the program, if we want to meet our commitments and obligations, I think we've got to come back to this again from a small forest landowner advisory committee standpoint and from a legislative authorization standpoint.
So Aaron, could I just say that, you mentioned the people that hold the purse strings. People that hold the purse strings, are they privy to this presentation, or would they be? I think small forest landowners ought to be presenting that.
I agree, and that's something that information gets to the legislature as well.
Thank you. Any discussion before we close this one out?
Thank you.
We will have spent time on almost every staff report item before we're through. Joe, did you have anything you wanted to add on the Upland Wildlife report? I had one item. But...
No, I haven't. So I hadn't really prepared anything, Mr. Chair.
I just want to draw the board's attention to there's a Taylor Checkerspot Butterfly component of the Upland Wildlife Working Group report. Fish and Wildlife Service finalized their listing and critical habitat decision. And so, as many of you already know, the board staff is required by rule to confer between DNR and WDFW, make a recommendation to the board as to whether the board should amend its critical habitat rules around the species when there is the occasion of a federal listing or critical habitat designation. And you all got a memo, I think, 2-3 weeks in front of the board meeting around staff's recommendation, which is at this point in time to not add Taylor Checkerspot Butterfly to the list of critical habitat state, because the federal government shutdown has sort of prevented staff from being able to acquire the GIS information from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to look at the overlay between the board's current approach and designated federal critical habitat. And so it's pretty hard to assess whether the current approach works unless you know where the landowners are, who they might be, whether the voluntary planning approach is something that's well suited to that location and that group of landowners. And so we do have the GIS data now, and between now and the February meeting, we'll have a more complete recommendation around whether we think the current approach continues to be the right one or something else is appropriate. So I didn't want to have that stuck in your email archives and never to be seen again. But any questions on that? Okay. You're a model of efficiency this morning. Do we lose Hotbed? I'm just going to audible him to come up and talk about extensive riparian test status and trends. So I'm going to run out and grab him. Surprise. Okay, well, let's then take our break a little bit early, and we'll go find Jim over break, move that item up, and the reason I'm not wanting to jigger around too much more with the agenda is because we've got some external folks coming for the spot-all implementation team discussion, so I want to make sure they have time to get here. So let's come back together in 15 minutes, let's say, quarter after. And hopefully we'll have Jim by then.
Yes, there's a little